argument this morning is Samuelson against the LaPorte Community School Corporation.
May it please the court. In this First Amendment retaliation case, the district court improperly granted summary judgment and used summary judgment to resolve a litany of factual disputes, denying Coach Samuelson his day in court. Coach Samuelson, it bears mentioning, was the most successful girls basketball coach in LaPorte, Indiana high school history. Jurors here are experts at being employees, and they are in a much better position to judge.
The girls apparently didn't agree with that, though, did they?
Pardon, Your Honor?
I say the girls apparently did not agree with that statement.
Well, if the court is referring to the petition that 13 members of the team signed against Coach Samuelson, I would argue that reason given by LaPorte Schools is pretextual, and it's pretextual for at least four reasons. First off, while the girls signed a petition saying they wouldn't play for Coach Samuelson, they in fact played the day they signed the petition. In addition, this petition was signed on the heels of a rather embarrassing defeat in which the 13 upperclassmen on the team were benched in favor of younger players. Thirdly, the petition itself was about playing time, and other coaches, such as Bill Reed, the tennis coach, had petitions signed against him. Players didn't want to play for him, yet LaPorte Schools did not terminate Coach Reed. And that goes to our main issue of disputed fact. The tennis coach, Bill Reed, was treated differently, and LaPorte Schools has given absolutely no reason why. They claim he's not similarly situated. Coach Reed is similarly situated. They're both subject to the same supervisor, Athletic Director Ed Gilland. They're both subject to the same standards of conduct and job performance. And thirdly, as is required by the Radue versus Kimberly-Clark line of cases, they engaged in similar conduct. And in fact, it's easily arguable that Coach Reed's conduct was much more severe than Coach Samuelson's. He was the subject of a lawsuit, a second threatened lawsuit, and other complaints about the tennis program. While they're similarly situated, for some reason, LaPorte Schools gave Coach Reed two things they didn't give Coach Samuelson. Number one, they gave him a performance improvement plan. The athletic director sat down with him, wrote out his job deficiencies, and worked with him to help improve his tennis coaching abilities in the tennis program. Never did that with Coach Samuelson, even after 4 years of Coach Samuelson being in charge of the program. Secondly, and more egregious, the superintendent recommended that Coach Reed be terminated because of problems in the tennis program. Coach Reed was given by Superintendent Blad a due process hearing in front of the entire school board, given the opportunity to refute the charges against him, given essentially a chance to explain his case. Coach Samuelson was never given that opportunity. Coach Samuelson was fired in February of 2003. Coach Reed was fired in May of 2003. No reason has been given by the LaPorte School Corporation as to why those two coaches were treated differently. Our second major contention of disputed fact that the district court glossed over is that Coach Samuelson, the season following his removal as the head girls basketball coach, was denied for an eighth grade coaching position, where inexplicably he was the only candidate. He was told by the middle school athletic director, the job was his, you're the only candidate. This is a job that Coach Samuelson had done in the past. Before he became the high school head coach, he was the middle school coach. He was told by the athletic director, the job is yours. The principal signed off on the blue form, which is the sheet that was sent to payroll to inform them that he has the job. That same day, the athletic director from the high school, it was by email, inquired about the rumor surrounding the middle school coaching position. Middle school athletic director responded, well, Greg is the only candidate. Looks like the job is his.
Did the school board know anything about this?
I don't think the school board knew anything about the eighth grade position, although it's interesting that Athletic Director Gilling said he had nothing to do with hiring at the middle school level, yet intervened to create a search committee for this eighth grade position.
I don't understand what any of this has to do with this litigation. We don't hire and fire middle school basketball coaches here.
Well, a jury needs to determine whether or not...
Juries don't hire and fire middle school basketball coaches. What is your legal theory?
That there are disputed issues of fact about the termination of Coach Samuelson from his head coaching position and the failure to hire him. There are similarly situated coaches who were hired for middle school...
Legal theory. I understood from your brief that your legal theory was that the school had violated the First Amendment by requiring your client to raise his questions internally before going outside the school board. Is that your legal theory?
That is, Your Honor. And that goes to our...
What have you to say about our holding in Wernsing against Thompson that public officials have immunity against an essentially identical claim? Your briefs don't discuss Wernsing. Wernsing was noted by your adversary. And failing to discuss what appears to be a dispositive precedent against you is not apt to persuade us, but this is your opportunity. So what do you have to say about Wernsing?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that the retaliation against Coach Samuelson...
What do you have to say about Wernsing?
I'm not prepared to address Wernsing, Your Honor. If I could address that on rebuttal, I'd like that opportunity. In addition to the disputed issues surrounding Coach Samuelson and tennis coach Bill Reed, there's a disputed issue of fact concerning Coach Samuelson's coaching ability. The district court ignores that there are two players testifying in favor of Coach Samuelson's teaching and coaching methods and one against, that there are two assistant coaches testifying in favor of Coach Samuelson's coaching ability.
None of this is pertinent. If you would address the First Amendment claim, you would at least have, your argument would have some relation to why this case is in federal court.
Well, the policy used here by the school corporation acted as a prior restraint in conjunction with the what we've described as the Blad memo. The day before Coach Samuelson was terminated, he was ordered by the superintendent of the schools not to try to influence board members. That is First Amendment protected activity.
Why?
Well, the Indiana Constitution itself gives...
We do not enforce the Indiana Constitution. This is not a case about state law. The reason for being in federal court is that you're claiming this First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Now, do you have some authority for the proposition that the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States entitles public employees to bypass the chain of command, that is, to raise an objection to the way that school or anything else is being administered to the press before the person speaks to his supervisors? So far as I know, every federal agency has such a requirement. Maybe most state agencies do, too. So if so, you would expect there'd be a lot of precedent. Is there any precedent you're relying on?
No, not with respect to the chain of command, Your Honor, but we assert that Coach Samuelson was...
Well, if you have no precedent in your favor on the First Amendment theory, then, of course, one problem, in addition to the fact that, well, lack of precedent suggests you don't have a good case, is qualified immunity. That's why I raised Wernsing, which said that the defendants have qualified immunity in an essentially identical case challenging a chain of command rule.
We're not only challenging the chain of command rule, we're challenging the termination and the retaliation.
But there's no problem if you violate a lawful rule, you can be penalized. Right? It's retaliation only if the rule is unconstitutional.
Well, we provided to the district court with evidence of two other teachers who were retaliated against for speaking out.
If the rule is lawful, you can be penalized, right? If it's a crime to drive 75 miles an hour on the freeway, you can be penalized for driving 75 miles an hour, even if other people are not. Selective prosecution is perfectly lawful. Only if the rule is a violation of the Constitution is there a potential for a problem.
Well, the rule itself and the way it was implemented by LaPorte Schools acted as an unconstitutional prior restraint against speech.
Right, and that's why I asked if you had even a single case in the history of the United States so holding.
Well, Pickering and its line of cases balance the First Amendment rights of public employees. And here we have a policy that was used as a prior restraint to stifle speech before it started based on its content. Coach Samuelson was required to go to the superintendent before getting permission to speak out to board members about matters of public concern. We're not talking about what kind of basketballs he used or what kind of color the uniforms were that the girls wore. We're talking about issues involving Title IX, and the treatment of girls' athletics in general, issues involving the computer platforms used by the schools, issues involving redistricting, and issues involving...
As I say, if it's so obviously unconstitutional, I should think you would be able to cite at least one case.
Well, the...
Didn't the chain of command rule only apply to administrative complaints by its terms?
That's what the school corporation asserts, but that's not how it was applied to Coach Samuelson. The Blad memo given on February 17th of 2003 ordered him not to influence board members. Doesn't tell him he can't influence board members about what kind of erasers he uses in the classroom. We're talking about big picture issues that are entitled to First Amendment protection. He's complaining against school corporation policies and procedures. In his mind, in order to make those policies and procedures better and to make a better school corporation. And the actions by the school corporation retaliated against him because of that speech.
What specifically did they retaliate against him for?
For opposing the administration policies, for basically being a thorn in the side. As the record shows, Coach Samuelson was involved in Title IX complaints back in the mid-1990s. He's continued to be actively involved in trying to get equal treatment for girls' athletics. School Corporation didn't like it. They wanted to shut him up, and so they fired him as head girls' basketball coach.
Did they ever even know about that?
Yes. Yes, the athletic director, Ed Gillen, testified in his deposition about the prior Title IX activity and about other speech by Coach Samuelson. I'm going into my rebuttal time, so I'd like a break now. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Kerr.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Brian Curry. I'm here today representing the appellees, LaPorte Community School Corporation, Kenneth Blad, Mitch Fikes, Tom Dermody, Ruth Minnick, Carol Shin, Ron Gigliotti, Susan Silagi, and Mary McDermott. Your Honors, the record in this case is abundantly clear that Mr. Samuelson's contract as the basketball coach at LaPorte High School was not renewed for one basic reason, and that reason is the state of the basketball program. As the basketball coach, he was captain of the ship. He was responsible not just for wins and losses, but for the overall public appearance of the program and the health of the program, if you will. It's very clear from the record that 13 of 13 varsity girls signed a petition saying they would refuse to play for him any further.
Counsel, I don't understand why that is pertinent. We are not in the business of hiring and firing eighth grade basketball coaches. I would like you, just as I hope that Mr. Rubel could be brought to address the First Amendment argument.
Well, I would agree.
It's a violation of the First Amendment to have this rule requiring someone to work through the chain of command before making a statement to the public.
I would agree with the court that based on the Walmart decision and several others that we're not here to be a super personnel department. My point is that in bringing those issues up is that it's clear that there is no retaliation, and it's with respect to the rule you're referring to. This is the guideline 1110, and I believe that rule is the chain of command rule we're talking about is not unconstitutional, and it is fully compliant with the relevant precedent relative to chain of command, internal housekeeping procedures for government employees. The district court correctly held, I believe, that this is not a prior restraint. As we've argued in our brief, the chain of command does not restrict the content of his speech. It only directs the first few steps of his speech. If he's unhappy with the result, then he can continue to speak up and to the point of the board.
Mr. Curry, what is not clear to me is the scope of this rule. What speech does it apply to?
Well, Mr. Samuelson, among with other government employees, wears several hats. He has a hat as a private citizen. He has a hat as the employee. The speech that we're talking about, I believe, on the face of the rule is restricted only to matters that can be resolved and should be resolved through the administrative channels.
Because these are matters for which he has some sort of governmental responsibility?
Not necessarily only that, but there's certainly things that he is involved in as a teacher, as a coach, or in his other extra duty activities that are properly addressed through those channels.
Now, you said as a teacher, as a coach, as an employee, he has no responsibility for whether a green tint is put on the windows of the classroom to conserve energy. Is that right?
Well, this is an issue that was addressed, and I think
it's the issue upon which you waffled in your entire brief. And this is why I'm trying to pin you down to it. I think it's important. What is the scope of this policy? Does it apply to matters that this teacher encounters in the course of his employment?
I believe it does.
Or matters involving the school for which he has no employee responsibility?
I think it would relate to the former. And I think in the context of the case, Your Honor, the issues that that Mr. Samuelson was being criticized for going to the board reflected, in most instances, his personal complaints about high school basketball and so forth. So I think, again, on its face, he's not prevented from bringing matters to the board if there are general public concerns. And in any event...
Okay, the tint on the windows.
Tint on the windows, I think that's a similar issue to one that came up with respect to the computer choice of whether or not we're going to use a universal Mac and Windows operating software. What the district court held, and we would agree with what the district court held on that, is that this is an issue, unless there's something that has to do with an exorbitant amount of taxpayer money being wasted, it's a discretionary function of the schools. Is there a wisdom to putting tint on the windows? Sure. But it's also something that's not necessarily the wide-ranging constitutional Title IX type issue that perhaps, as the district court said, although I would not necessarily agree with it based on other issues that in our brief, could be gone directly to the board.
Funding for foreign language clubs.
Again, I think we're talking about small things that can be addressed within the school.
Even though he has no responsibility for these as an employee, he's not in the foreign language department of that school, right?
As far as I know, I'm not aware that he's in the foreign language department.
Yeah. So it seems, can you give me an example of something that would not be subject to this policy he might want to address the board about?
I think if there were something of grave concern in terms of school security, things like that, they could go. He could go
school
as a citizen.
School security, though, wouldn't that involve his own responsibilities?
It may overlap, and there may be some areas that could potentially be.
But your policy doesn't in any way delineate between these two, does it? I mean, intelligent teacher picking up this policy. Do they know? What falls under this policy and what they can go and talk to the board about, or do they have to act at their peril?
Well, I don't necessarily know that they're acting at their peril if they are going through the chain of command.
No, if they don't go through the chain of command and go to the school board, you're going to fire them.
Well, I think that I'm not aware of any specific circumstances in this case where any employee in the record was fired for circumventing the chain of command. Certainly Mr. Samuelson had some discussions about it, but he's still teaching to this day. And with that in mind, he is still free to continue up the chain of command to raise these problems as he sees them and ultimately get to the board, which is maybe...
Isn't it fair to say that you want the teacher to bring everything up through the chain of command?
I think that's a fair statement that things that can be resolved. If I may make an analogy, when we as litigants are in the district court, we're required to try and work things out in discovery disputes before we bring discovery motions. The idea of the policy, again, is to keep every single dispute from clogging up the board's time. The board has limited time and resources. If something can be resolved through administrative channels, it should go that way first. There's no restrictions on what can be brought to the board. There's no what can be brought through the chain of command. And the people who are making decisions along the way to the chain of command cannot prohibit Mr. Samuelson or anyone else from ultimately going to the board.
Do the parties agree on that?
Well, I think the rule states on his face that once you get through the chain of command just short of the board, that the administration has to then set up.
My question was, do the parties agree on that?
I, 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 I can't recall whether they dispute that particular point or not, but on its face, I don't think there's any evidence of it being a prior restraint. I think it's consistent with the law, and I don't believe there's any precedent to say that these chain-of-command type rules are across the board always going to be unconstitutional.
Well, no, I don't think anybody's debating that. The question is this of sufficient? Is this one sufficiently cabined that it deals with this person's employment responsibilities as opposed to his privileges as a citizen?
I believe it is.
What in the policy delineates between the two?
It says it's
just told me that anything that has to do with the school board, he'd better go through the chain of command.
Well, it has to do, Your Honor, with things that can be resolved through administrative action short of the school board have to go up through. That, I think, is the delineation.
And what's the situation with respect to redistricting? My problem with some of these things is I don't know the context. I don't know what was said. I don't know why it was said. It's a very sketchy, and I don't think it's your fault. But the description of what the complaint is very sketchy, and I don't know what kind of a pigeonhole to put it in. What was this business about redistricting all about?
I have to confess, Your Honor, I'm not exactly sure. And I think that's part of the point. There's the University of Wisconsin case that we cited and some other portions of the brief that talk about what First Amendment expression is. And you have to get beyond certain vagaries. And this is even further to the point that what we're talking about, these issues of speech and whether or not his speaking out is what he was retaliated for. As far as I understand it, The record is clear that the retaliation, the failure to renew his contract, or the decision not to renew his contract, came on the heels of issues that are not susceptible to this court's review, being whether or not he was running a good basketball program. The decision whether or not to retain a woman as from interim principal to full-time principal, that happened well in advance of this. The 1993 and 1995 GAAC and Title IX issues that were raised happened well in advance of this. Since that time, he was continuing.
He apparently had a committee to pick a principal, wasn't he? So that he was involved in his occupation. He was involved with this issue.
Indeed, he was, and that was in.
I don't know what he was involved with the redistricting. I don't think.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to talk over you, Judge, but I think that the allegations about the redistricting are too vague for us to even determine whether or not they rise to the level of protected speech, as with any of the complaints, for that matter, as we've outlined in the brief. And in any event, they're so attenuated in time from the actual termination and the reasons for termination. There's no way you could argue that the fact that all the players, and several of the parents and the assistant coaches were threatening to leave the team, threatening not to play. This is the reason why there was termination, not any speech he's made. Indeed, he's still employed as a teacher. He's still doing these extra duty decisions, responsibilities.
Did anybody say to him when he was talking about redistricting that you're violating the chain of command rule?
I can't recollect from the record if anybody threatened him with termination based on that. And in any event, the termination that did happen was only for his basketball responsibilities, and it was much further down the line. If they wanted to get rid of him because he was a thorn in the side, as counsel suggested, he would not be continuing to teach and continuing to perform all these other responsibilities. They're simply stated there's no basis for the plaintiff's claim that he was retaliated for First Amendment in this record. And there's ample basis for others.
Does this litigation in the end turn on the First Amendment? And what about the holding of Jackson against the Birmingham Board of Education?
I can't recollect that decision off the top of my head.
The Supreme Court held in Jackson that Title IX itself provides a right of action for somebody who is retaliated against for raising a Title IX argument.
As far as I'm aware, though, Judge, that's not in the complaint in this case. It was a 1983 claim.
The law. Now, maybe the fact that Mr. Rubel has never identified Jackson as a source of authority is dispositive here, but it seems very odd to be arguing about what the First Amendment does or doesn't provide when the Supreme Court has held that Title IX itself provides a right of action.
Well, regardless of whether Title IX provides a right of action, I think it's abundantly clear that the justification for firing him is ample and well substantiated in the record. There's whether or not he's making Title IX complaints to the extent that they've actually even been articulated. He's never raised that as a basis, Your Honor, for the retaliation. He's never raised a private right of Title IX, and I don't know. Frankly, I don't think one could be substantiated based on the record. Mm-hmm. And if there's nothing further, I waive the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Curry.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Anything further, Mr. Rubel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I apologize for not addressing Wernsing versus Thompson in the opening. Dealing with qualified immunity, while it is true that the courts have found qualified immunity when a policy does not violate the First Amendment, and that certain policies that are considered chain of command policies do not violate the First Amendment, it's the contention here that this policy itself acted as a prior restraint. Not just the policy's words as it was written, but as it was applied by Superintendent Blad. The policy itself requires Coach Samuelson or others to get permission before speaking to board members about public
That's
issues.
What a chain of command policy does, all right.
That's right.
Do you have a comment now on Wernsing?
I do, Your Honor, that the chain of command policy as applied by the LaPorte School Corporation is distinguishable because it targeted the content of speech, not just with Coach Samuelson, but with two other teachers, Karen Bortz and Myrna Harder.
I'm lost. All chain of command policies have some domain, that is, the kind of speech they cover, that is, speech related to work. We have Judge Ripple's question and my colleague Judge Cuddy's question about what this policy did in fact cover. But all chain of command policies deal with the subject matter of employment. So if the FBI says, before you go screaming to the press about the way we conduct our investigations, raise it through the chain of command so we can fix your problem, that policy deals with the way the FBI conducts investigations and not with trips to Disneyland, for example. So they all have subject matter limits. That obviously doesn't make them all unconstitutional. So I don't understand. Is there some material difference between this chain of command policy and the chain of command policy that was involved in Wernsing?
Yes, Your Honor. You raise a Garcetti type of argument that if, of course, the chain of command can be required for teachers to talk about what kind of textbooks they're using, what kind of basketballs they use on the court. When teachers want to speak out about policy issues, issues that they have a right to as a citizen, as taxpayers, as parents of students.
You're not addressing my question, which is the difference between this policy and the policy at stake in Wernsing.
This policy, in this case, unlike Wernsing, was applied to stifle speech that the administration...
That was the plaintiff's claim in Wernsing. Have you ever read Wernsing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then you should be able to address the difference.
The main difference, Your Honor, is that unlike Wernsing, in this case, the superintendent issued a gag order.
Was the plaintiff's claim in Wernsing. That is not a difference.
The gag order in this case was directed to Coach Samuelson not to speak to board members.
Well, it's true that there was no gag order in Wernsing addressed to Coach Samuelson, but I don't think that's a helpful difference.
What happened with respect to redistricting, just for my information?
According to the testimony of one board member, Ruth Minnick, and the testimony of Coach Samuelson, the administration, under Superintendent Blad, had put forth a redistricting proposal. Coach Samuelson, as a citizen, didn't believe that that was a good redistricting proposal, that it was a shifting of resources, and not good for the LaPorte Community School Corporation in general. He spoke out about that as a citizen.
Did anybody tell him he was violating any rules when he did that?
No, Your Honor. But the chain of command policy in this case was used to punish and to prevent Coach Samuelson from speaking out. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.